Yeah, the most amazing thing about this discovery is that it was predicted 100 years ago with exquisite precision, when the person making the prediction didn't even know that the theory predicted black holes, and in fact was very suspicious of them for a long time. Einstein realized that his theory gave gravitational waves, which would move at the speed of light, and that was sort of obvious from the way the theory was constructed by analogy with Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism, which I'll describe in this lecture. But he didn't know the theory predicted black holes. It took people about 50 years to become comfortable with that. And then observations gradually gave clues that there really might be black holes in the universe. But only this year was the first direct observation of black holes, two black holes merging, emitting gravitational waves. And this is really a new era in astronomy, in physics, that we're able to do extremely precise measurements of the universe, of very fundamental physics, nothing more fundamental than Einstein's theory of gravity. And very precise measurements, which will tell us a lot. Okay, so welcome to relativity, Psi relativity. We're going to do relativity in 3 weeks. It's not going to be easy, but the only way we're going to get through this is if you ask lots of questions. Don't allow me to lose you. Don't allow me to make mistakes. You give me a hard time, and I'll try and give you a little bit of a hard time, too, occasionally. I hope you now realize perimeter is quite a special place, and it's up to each one of us to make it even more special. And we do that by interacting a lot. Okay, so the outline of the course. I'm not going to use slides, by the way. I just at the beginning. Sorry, leave it for the moment. No, leave it for the moment. Oh, too late. I wanted to show another slide, but I won't. Okay, so the outline of the course is very simple, which is that week one, we will do special relativity. Week two, we will do general relativity. And week three, we will do gravitational waves, black holes, and cosmology. Okay, so I want you to get a little picture of what relativity is all about. I'm going to recommend just a few textbooks. There's a million textbooks on relativity. I'm not really following any of them, but I would recommend Sean Carroll, Space, Time, and Geometry. And that's available as some lecture notes online if you want it free. And Tony Z, this is a relatively recent book. Einstein in a nutshell. And a book that I quite like, which is a little bit more mathematical. This is called Introduction to General Relativity, and it's the London Mathematical Society, 1991. So before we get into the nitty-gritty of special relativity, let me just tell you something mind-blowing, okay? Which is, what LIGO has done is open a new pair of eyes on the universe. And this is what I am currently very excited about, is that when we look at the universe, it is expanding. So here is space, and this is time. And this is a very schematic picture. But we sit somewhere here. The present age of the universe is around 14 billion years. And we look out in space, and we see backwards in time. And so whatever we see is obviously happened earlier, like those two black holes were a billion years ago. If we look all the way back towards the Big Bang, we're looking back some 14 billion years. And what is so fascinating about gravitational waves is that we can use them to probe what happened here, okay, in the very early universe. So let's think about strong gravity. Okay, so in other words, what is the scale on which gravity becomes very strong? Now you can figure this out just from undergraduate physics. Gravity becomes strong when the Newtonian potential, this is the Newtonian potential, when phi over c squared is approximately 1. And you know by dimensions that the Newtonian potential is gm over r, and gm over r is v squared. It's a velocity squared. So this is obviously a dimensionless number, a velocity squared divided by the speed of light squared. And when this is 1, you know gravity is strong. So to probe a scale r, you need a wavelength lambda less than r. You know that from thinking about a microscope. You can only see small things if you use short wavelengths. But the problem is that when you use short wavelengths to probe something, you have a lot of energy. Okay, so the energy of a photon with wavelength lambda, or indeed a gravitational wave with wavelength lambda, is the momentum times c. H over lambda times c. And that's got to be bigger than hc over r. And so phi over c squared goes like g e over c fourth r. Here I'm using the fact that m equals e over c squared. We're going to prove that in a moment, that E equals mc squared. And so if I want the gravitational potential, I want gm over r c squared, but m is E over c squared. And that's bigger than gh over c cubed r squared. This is of order 1 for r equal to gh over c cubed to the 1/2 and that's the Planck length. So if you start trying to probe something on a scale of the Planck length, gravity is very strong. And actually what that means is you're going to make a black hole. And you won't be able to see what's on scale smaller than the Planck length, because the moment you try to look at it, it will turn into a black hole. So that's the smallest scale. Scale that it's possible to probe geometry. L Planck, which is this number, is about 1.6 times 10 to the minus 35 meters. Let me try and move those up. And what about the larger scale? What's the largest scale we can probe in the universe? Anyone have any idea? Yes?
The observable universe.
Which is how big? How big? I want a number in meters. How big is the observable universe in meters? Has anyone heard of dark energy? Do you know what dark energy is? Who can tell me what dark energy is? Yes?
The theoretical compound of the universe which is responsible for this accelerated expansion.
Correct. Who guessed the dark energy? Who first introduced dark energy as a concept? He didn't call it that.
Einstein.
Einstein, yes, 1917. And he noticed that if he introduced this special form of energy, he could make the universe static. That was his motivation. It was not a good motivation, because the universe is not static, but that was his motivation, and he relied on it being repulsive. Okay. Now, dark energy is a weird thing. It's in many ways the simplest form of energy, even though we have no idea what it is. It's very simple because it's the same in space and it's the same in time. When you say dark energy, you mean a component of the energy that is constant everywhere in space, doesn't vary, and it's constant in time. It doesn't change. The universe can expand, but this energy density in the dark energy remains absolutely fixed. And that dark energy was only discovered in the 1990s. And it defines a length. So the dark energy density, let's call it rho lambda. That's an energy per unit volume. Defines a scale. Just through the same argument, g rho lambda r squared. So here I'm calculating g m over r. M is rho r cubed. So g rho r squared over c squared. This is an energy. So rho over c squared is a mass density. And I need one more c squared to make this dimensionless. So this is phi over c squared is 1 when r is c squared over square root of g rho lambda. And let's call that L lambda. It's a length scale defined by the dark energy density. Lambda is the cosmological constant, which was Einstein's name for the dark energy. So L lambda is this scale. It's also, roughly speaking, the Hubble radius today. But as you said, because lambda, the dark energy, causes the universe expansion to accelerate, it actually defines an upper limit to the scale beyond which we will never see. Okay? Stuff which is further away from us than this length scale is going to be accelerated away from us so fast that we will never see it. Even if it emits light, it will never reach us. Okay, so this is what we've learned in the last 20 years, that actually there is an upper limit to the size of the universe we shall ever see. And it's deeply, deeply puzzling. It might mean that the universe is finite, after all. It's not infinite. It might mean that beyond this scale, there is a multiverse of random possibilities, which again, we shall never see. And many people speculate about this multiverse. In my view, this is not really science, but people do it anyway. And this presence of this dark energy sweeping everything beyond this scale, beyond view, is one of the greatest paradoxes in modern physics. Okay, and it should be, I think, a clue to the next theory beyond relativity and quantum mechanics. And I hope one of you will make that theory. Okay, so we are entering a phase rather similar to the phase Einstein enters physics in which there were crises. We have a number of crises, and this is one of them. This dark energy length scale is equal to 17.4 times 10 to the 9 light years. Okay, so roughly speaking, it's the age of the universe times the speed of light. And that is a new fundamental length scale in physics. It's 1.65 times 10 to the 26 meters. Okay, so we have the smaller scale in physics, and we have the larger scale. Yes?
But this is greater than the age of the universe, so it is not a problem for us yet.
No, it's not a problem. The reason, you see, at the moment, the dark energy doesn't, the universe has other stuff in it than dark energy. So the total density is 70% this, actually 69% this, and 31% everything else. The everything else is going to dilute away. Okay, so this isn't quite the Hubble constant. It's kind of the asymptotic Hubble constant in the far future. And so this is actually the fundamental scale. We happen to be living at a time when there's other stuff that interferes with this, but this is the fundamental scale. Now, something, a little bit of numerology might be, okay, there's these fundamental scales in physics. Physics seems to be rather simple on this scale. The universe is incredibly smooth and uniform on large scales. Physics seems to be rather simple on small scales. Okay, after all, the Large Hadron Collider has failed to find anything beyond the Standard Model, right? There's no evidence for anything beyond the Standard Model. There was some, and then in the last month or two, it went away. So physics appears to be extremely simple on very large scales and on very small scales. So it's rather natural to take the geometric mean. If I want to find out what's in the middle, let's just take the geometric mean. Okay, so that turns out to be 10 to the minus 4 meters within a factor of 2. That's about the size of a living cell. Okay. This seems to be the way physics works, that it's simple on large scales, it's simple on small scales, and all the complicated stuff is in the middle on this scale. And that's the scale on which molecules, life, consciousness form. and on which complexity achieves its maximum. So at least the picture I have of physics is there's this length scale from the very small to the very large. And on both extremes, there's not much complexity. And then in the middle, the complexity grows in as a different dimension, which is complexity. And this, so this is the scale of living cells. So I thought this was just a funny coincidence, okay? And I mentioned it in my book, my popular book. But this really comes to life with LIGO, because gravitational waves allow us to build a cosmic microscope, okay, with which we can see the Big Bang. And it turns out it explains this factor. Well, explains is a bit of a strong word, but it gives that factor. So cosmic G-wave microscope. We can use these gravitational waves to see the very early universe. You see, the wonderful thing about gravitational waves is that they are hardly impeded by the hot plasma of the early universe. In the early universe, we know it was dominated by radiation and ionized charged particles. Until 400,000 years after the Big Bang. The plasma is opaque to electromagnetic waves. So using electromagnetic radiation, we can only see back to what we call the surface of last scattering, which is 400,000 years after the Big Bang. Using gravitational waves, we can see all the way back to the singularity. Okay, so people like me who make theories of the singularity are very excited because we can now test those theories. So let me show you, I'll explain this heuristically. You see, if I take this picture of the universe, it's expanding, and we're going to see in this course how the size of the universe can change. As the universe expands, the waves within it, like gravitational waves, are stretched with the expansion. Okay, just imagine taking space to be a torus, for example, a box with periodic boundary conditions. Put a wave in that box and now expand the box. Well, nothing you do is going to change the number of oscillations of the wave. Right, the size of the box is going to change. So if it had two nodes, it's going to still have two nodes. And as you expand it, the wavelength is just going to grow with the size of the universe. So waves grow with the size of the universe. And if I measure a wave now, a gravitational wave now, and follow it back in time, I can figure out where it came from and how it could, when it could have been produced. Learn about the universe at that time. So if our detector size is millimeters, then the time probed is the Planck time. Okay, so the Planck time is 'm able to build a detector, which, you know, it's a stretch to go to millimeters, is a stretch to build a gravitational wave detector that can see waves that short, I will be learning about what happened at the Planck time. The waves were produced at the Planck time with a wavelength equal to the Planck time multiplied by the speed of light, and then stretched forward to today. A millimeter sounds like a stretch, but actually people are building gravitational wave detectors with wavelengths of meters today. There exists one in Fermilab, and that's why I'm missing Thursday and Friday this week, because I'm going to speak to the experimentalists there to try to encourage them to probe this. So meters is definitely feasible. And in fact, Azumina Avanitaki has a design for meter-sized gravitational wave detector. And it will be probing scales a little bit bigger than the Planck length, a few orders of magnitude bigger than the Planck length. Now, of course, LIGO is much bigger than a millimeter. And you can ask yourself, how big can we go? What's the biggest gravitational wave detector we could feasibly build and or use in nature? And what wavelengths will it be probing? Okay, so it turns out that nature provides a gravitational wave detector for us whose scale is light years. Okay, and that is, does anyone know what that is? It's a natural gravitational wave detector. What's the second weirdest object in astrophysics after a black hole? Yes?
Pulsar.
Pulsar, very good. So a neutron star, which is spinning, emits pulses of radiation, which are detected. They are almost perfect clocks. So these pulses are emitted with incredible precision. And you can, if you have several of these stars, you can literally measure the distance to the neutron star, to each of the neutron stars, by, rather, you can measure the change in the distance by measuring the change in the pulse arrival times. Okay? And so far, they have not detected any gravitational waves. Gravitational waves change the length between us and the pulsar. They've not detected any yet, and so they are able to set limits on how many gravitational waves there are. These limits are already rather interesting. But the scale of the waves is light years, because we have a collection of neutron stars at these distances from us. And over the next decade or two, we will acquire tens of thousands of neutron stars. And this will all become extremely precise. You can ask yourself, what time does a wavelength of light years probe today? And it turns out it is T nuclear synthesis in the universe. It's about 10 to the minus 3 seconds. Okay, so using gravitational waves, we will be able to probe the state of the universe before nuclear synthesis, all the way back to the Planck time. Okay, so it really is an amazing thing that nature has provided us with a microscope which will allow us to see what really happened. So I think that's extremely exciting. It rests on this square root. And maybe at the end of the course, I'll explain where the square root comes from. Any questions? Well, I hope I've conveyed that this is an incredibly exciting subject right now. Okay. It's simply, I mean, we had the announcement of the LIGO detection in the bistro in February, and it was the most amazing announcement I've ever attended in my life, to see the precision of the result and the agreement with Einstein's theory 100 years after the theory was just spectacular. So this is an amazing, amazing field. And it's going to get more amazing, as I've explained. What I haven't mentioned is the gravitational waves measured on even larger scales, right? Cosmic scales. So we can look for gravitational waves whose wavelength is as large as this. right? And you may be aware last year that there was a claimed detection of the signal of gravitational waves produced at the Big Bang. Anybody aware of that? Yes. What was the experiment?
BICEP.
Yes. So the BICEP experiment claimed to see gravitational waves. This was claimed by many to be the smoking gun of inflation. Stephen Hawking went on radio and he said he'd won his bet with me, and I had to now pay him $200 Canadian. And basically people went nuts for a month or two, and they were totally wrong. They had not detected gravitational waves. They had detected dust, and so this would be T lambda, which would be, actually it would be T naught, which would be 10 to the, which would be 13.8. So it's certainly still, that claim went away. It's very important. People are probing gravitational waves on large scales. The limits are coming down. I've agreed with Hawking that when the bound on gravitational waves falls below 5% of the total signal in the anisotropy of the microwave sky, that he will pay me $200 Canadian. Currently, it's at 7%. The initial claim was 20%. Now it's down to 7%, and so I'm smiling. Okay, so that's interesting, but so far no evidence for gravitational waves on large scales. So let's go back to the 1860s. And this is the origin of relativity. Maxwell, you may well know, was this amazing, amazing person who, in many ways, his discoveries laid the foundation for special relativity, general relativity. He was Einstein's hero. He was a very, very modest personality. He attributed all of his discoveries to Faraday, Michael Faraday, who was an experimentalist who developed this intuition about fields. Faraday had the idea that it made no sense for the sun to attract the Earth at a distance without some intermediary. Faraday says it simply doesn't make sense that if I move the sun by a centimeter, the Earth would instantly feel that effect. Surely the influence of the sun on the Earth must, the influence must travel. And what is going to carry the influence? Well, it must be a field. And so Faraday argued fields had to exist. They had to fill space. They had to travel across space. And it was that basic insight that led Maxwell to construct his theory. Now, Maxwell has an amazing story. I invite you to read any of the books about it, or even just look at the Wikipedia article. And he, around 1860, he was ready to try to mathematize the equations of electricity and magnetism. And two things happened to him in 1860. First of all, he was fired. Okay, he had a professorship at the University of Aberdeen, and there wasn't room for two chairs. They appointed somebody else to a professorship. There wasn't room for two, and so he was let go. The second thing that happened is he contracted smallpox, and he almost died. Okay? And that's when his work on electricity and magnetism began. So somehow, in this incredibly difficult life and environment, well, you see, the being fired from Aberdeen was kind of a blessing, because he had to look for a job elsewhere. And he looked at King's College London, and Michael Faraday was working in London. And so this brought him to London. He could interact a lot with Faraday. and that was critical. And by 1865 or so, he had all the equations of electricity and magnetism. So there's an amazing story behind it. And of course, his great discovery was that these equations predicted and explained what light is. And so to muck around with physics involving charges and forces and fields and currents and all of that, and then suddenly discover you'd explained light. And not only that, explained all electromagnetic radiation, X-rays, gamma rays, radio waves, everything in one go. I think that was probably the most amazing discovery in the history of physics. Certainly, it's pretty hard to compete with. But then, as we'll see, you see, it's within this discovery, it explained light, explained the speed of light. Immediately, there was a horrible conflict with Newton and Galileo. Because if you've predicted the speed of something, and it doesn't really make any sense in the context of Newton or Galileo, because speed is relative, as we know. If something's moving and you run after it, the speed decreases. So how can you predict an absolute speed? It makes no sense. And indeed, Maxwell's discovery had within it the seeds of special relativity, as we will now discuss. So Newton had to give way as a result of Maxwell's discovery, but that took 40 years or so to become evident. Okay, so Maxwell was studying electric and magnetic fields. Whose existence had been advocated by Faraday. Though Faraday called them lines of force. And Maxwell wrote down these equations. Okay, so Maxwell wrote down four equations for the electric and magnetic fields. And by the way, Maxwell had to invent partial derivatives and PDEs in order to do it. PDEs didn't really exist in a very well-developed form before Maxwell, so he had to develop a lot of the calculus of PDEs. He didn't write it in exactly this notation. He wrote it in longhand. But he had the right equations. Most of these equations were known before Maxwell, with the exception of one term. Okay, so this equation was postulated by Gauss, and of course it explains how electric charges. So rho e is the electric charge density. So that Q, the electric charge inside some volume V, is rho E. And JE, which is a vector, is the electric current density. so that dq dt, the rate of change in the charge contained within a volume V. So let me draw this picture again. We have some volume V with a surface S and surface element ds pointing outwards. And dq dt is minus integral je dot ds over the surface. So je gives the charge per unit area, per unit time, crossing a given surface element of the volume. And E and B, of course, are the electric and the magnetic fields. Now, this term was known by Gauss, so basically it says that electric charges cause electric fields. This equation was also known. It's sometimes just called the no-monopole equation, because there is nothing in nature which directly causes a magnetic field in the same way that electric charges cause electric fields. No monopoles. This equation was discovered by Faraday, that if you change magnetic fields, you create electric fields. And then this equation, without the extra term, was discovered by Ampere, that electric currents do cause magnetic fields, even though electric currents lead to electric fields. So this, if you like, is the analog of Gauss's law. What Maxwell realized is that these four equations without the extra term are actually inconsistent. And so Maxwell added this term. This is called Maxwell's displacement current. Added to make the equations consistent. So I'll show that in a moment. But it's an amazing example how mathematically clarifying the laws and then demanding consistency is incredibly powerful, because it was this term that gave rise to electromagnetic waves traveling at the speed of light. Now, some other notation. I'm using SI units. So mu naught is 4 pi times 10 to the minus 7 newtons per square amp. Epsilon naught is 1 over 4 pi times 9 times 10 to the 9. This is by definition, actually, the mu naught. Epsilon naught is measured to be this, Coulomb squared over Newton meter squared. OK, so these were experimentally measured numbers from Ampere's law and Gauss's law. And then just to recall, div E is di. I, where I equals 1, 2, 3, and we use the Einstein summation convention. Which means that repeated indices are summed. And then, of course, curl E is a vector whose ith component is, and I should say that di equals d by dxi. And xi is xy z in Cartesian coordinates. And of course, epsilon ijk is totally antisymmetric. And epsilon 1, 2, 3 equals plus 1. Okay, so, yes? Sorry?
I think there's an I in front of epsilon.
Oh, sorry, yeah. We don't need imaginary numbers yet. Thank you. Now, let's check the consistency. Let's check Maxwell equations for consistency. First, notice that from the definition, of rho E and J E, we have that d rho dt is equal to d rho dt plus divergence of J E equals 0. Okay, so to get that, I just take the time derivative of the first formula and equate it to the result from the second formula, and then use the divergence theorem to rewrite this in terms of dV, and then finally argue this is true for any volume, no matter how small or where it is. And so it must be true that the integrands are actually, that the total integrand is zero, and I get that equation. So, how can we check the consistency? Well, let's start with Faraday's law. Notice that if I take the divergence, partial derivatives commute. Okay, that's one of the things Maxwell, discovered or made clear. And so I can always take the divergence of Faraday's law, and the div B will be 0 by the no monopole law. So the right-hand side is obviously going to be 0. And the left-hand side, if I calculate div, so let's calculate the div of curl E. And so this is equal to di, and then epsilon ijk dj EK. Okay, but partial derivatives commute, so dI dj is the same as dj dI, and so the derivative term is symmetrical under I and j, but the epsilon term is antisymmetrical. And if you contract a symmetric thing with an antisymmetric thing, you have to get 0. And so this equals 0. And so the left-hand side and the right-hand side, if we take the div of dB dt, this is equal 0 by the no monopoles law. Good. So that equation is at least consistent with all the other equations. Uh, Now, what about Ampere's law? Okay, so Maxwell was just doing the same thing. Ampere. If we take the div of curl B, this is zero by exactly this argument. Okay, because we'll get something exactly like this, but with a B there. And then on, so the left-hand side, but on the right-hand side, what we get is mu naught div j. And there's no reason for that to be zero. In fact, by this equation, this is called the continuity equation. Equation or conservation of electric charge. So by that equation, div j is d rho dt. So if the density of charge changes, div j cannot be zero. If d rho e dt is not zero. And there's absolutely no reason you can't change the density of charges. You just move the charges around. So the equation has to be fixed. And what Maxwell noticed is that if you add the displacement current okay, then what you're going to get is mu naught epsilon naught d div e dt. But now we're going to use Gauss. And so this is mu naught epsilon naught, mu naught epsilon naught, the epsilon naught cancels, mu naught d rho e dt. And when you put these two things together, we're just going to get mu naught div j plus d rho e dt, which is zero. Okay, so Maxwell realized the way to fix the equations and to make consistency was to add that last term in orange. And when he did that, there was an absolutely amazing consequence. Which is that even if we set rho e and j e to zero, which naively you'd say, I've removed all the sources of the electric and magnetic fields. I've just taken out all the charges and all the currents. There are still interesting solutions. Very interesting solutions. So to see that, let us set rho and j to zero and just take the fourth equation and take the time derivative of it. So take the right-hand side, mu naught epsilon d2e dt squared. And then this is equal to, this is by the fourth equation, or modified Ampere. This is equal to db dt And this is equal to minus curl of E by Faraday. And now we just use a little bit of vector calculus that epsilon ijk dj epsilon klm dl em. And then I just use the usual epsilon-epsilon identity. These two epsilons have one index contracted. So let's get rid of the j over here. And then this is delta I L delta J M minus delta I M delta J L. And when you work that through, you just get minus div of a gradient, I should say, of div E minus D squared E. Plus. This is zero if rho e is zero. And so all we get is del squared e. And so what we find is the wave equation for e, i.e., the wave equation. With the speed c squared equals 1 over mu naught epsilon naught. OK, so by definition, the wave equation is d2 dt squared plus c squared grad squared some function equals 0. You need this factor of a speed in here because the dimensions of time and space are different. The c converts this from 1 over space squared to 1 over time squared. And so immediately you get waves traveling at the speed of light. And this was the really incredible part, is that Maxwell took these numbers from experimentalists, the mu naught and the epsilon naught, and he plugged it in. And he found that c is 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. I think in his day, his very first attempt was off by 10%. But that was pretty close. And he realized immediately that must be what light is. Okay, it's just a wave in the electric field. So let's just study the solution in a little bit more detail. Let's see if this is going to work. For example, let's take the electric field to be 0, 0, function x minus ct, any function of x minus ct. Now, the reason I put the electric field in the z direction, so only Ez is non-zero, the other ones are zero, is you see I'm having my wave travel in x. But I've got to satisfy that div E equals 0. So d by dx of Ex has to be 0. So the easy way to satisfy that is just to set Ex 0. I could, by the way, always add a constant field. Constant field is sort of trivial, right? If the E is constant in space, it clearly satisfies Maxwell's equations. But you can always say, you know, this is created by a charge at infinity or something. So constant fields are not interesting solutions because they extend off to infinity. The interesting ones are these sort of localized solutions, which are electromagnetic waves. So let's take E to be this. And then it turns out, not too surprising, you see, you've got to satisfy all four equations. So the B, you can, again, because it's going to be a function of x minus ct, you can only really put it in the z or y directions. You don't want to be x, because then you'll be in trouble with the no monopoles law. So, but you have to satisfy Faraday and then this modified Ampere law. Okay, so you see there's a cross product in Faraday and likewise in modified Ampere. That immediately tells you that the E and the B are going to be perpendicular. Right, so the answer is to put a B in like this with a factor 1 over C. You'll notice if you look at the equations that E and B have different units. Okay, so look at Faraday's law. On the left-hand side, we have a space derivative, and on the right-hand side, a time derivative. Clearly, they differ by a speed in units. And the speed is the speed of light. So B has unit, if this has units of electric field, this will have units of magnetic field. And then it's just a matter of algebra to check that this really satisfies all the Maxwell equations. So I'll leave that to you. And if we picture it, it looks like this. That's Y, this is Z, this is X. And this F here can be any function. And so what it looks like is the electric field is in the Z direction. Okay, so this will be Ez. And then the magnetic field is in the negative y direction. So it'll look like this, By. Okay, and that pulse of electromagnetic waves will travel happily along at the speed of light. Now, just for fun, you can find all the other solutions. For example, this is called a linearly polarized wave because the electric field is always in one direction. You can have the orthogonal polarization where it's in the y direction. Or you can have circular polarization where the electric and magnetic fields rotate around. As you sit at a given point in space, I will see the electric and magnetic fields going around in a circle. And I'll, again, leave it to you to find those solutions. But the important part is that we had this crazy formula. C is 1 over square root mu naught epsilon. Okay, that we have predicted a speed. And this is completely inconsistent with Galileo and Newton understanding of mechanics, because that understanding was based on the idea that if something is moving, if two objects move relative to each other, then speeds change. actually according to what's called the Galilean group, the Galilean transformation. It's just the obvious classical picture. That picture of mechanics just doesn't allow one to predict an absolute speed. But it took people about 40 years to appreciate that fact. Are there any questions? Since I'm lecturing twice this morning, maybe this is a good moment to take a break. any questions? Because basically we're now going to, what we're going to do is formulate the invariants of Maxwell's equations and then use that invariance as the foundation for our understanding of mechanics. Everything clear? You're not even answering that question. Give me something. Yes. Well, you asked too many questions. You go ahead.
Did Maxwell?
No, sorry. Let's him. Yeah. So, I don't mean too many. Yeah. Many is good, but.
So I wonder when you talked about the scale, what's like the most fundamental description of a scale? Because we talk about
like
bigger
scales. Yeah. So what I mean when I talk about a scale, what I mean is that we wrote down some laws. According to those laws, there's a length scale, which can be written in terms of the constants. I introduced a bunch of constants, like Newton's constant or this mu naught or epsilon naught. So I have to introduce some constants to make the laws of physics work. Out of those constants, I can write down a scale. And there's nothing I can do to the theory to change that scale. I mean, it's once I give you the theory, it defines the scale. Now, of course, you can then ask, what does that scale mean in the theory? You know, what physical process is it telling you about? In the case of the Planck scale, it's saying it's meaningless to talk about geometry on smaller scales than the Planck scale. In the case of the dark energy scale, it's telling you, well, you need to study the Einstein equations and the solutions, but in the end, it tells you, this is a scale beyond which you will never see the universe, right? That's a very fundamental thing. You know, we've kind of learned from quantum mechanics not to speak about things which we can't really observe. It's one of the lessons of quantum mechanics. Be a little bit suspicious of things you can't observe. In cosmology, that's what we've discovered in the last 20 years. There's a lot of stuff we can't observe. It's everything beyond this scale. We will never, 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 ever see it, okay? It makes me think maybe it doesn't exist. But I certainly believe people who make theories of what's going on out there, I think they are doing very questionable things, okay? Because they're talking about things which are unobservable, even in principle. And I'm sorry, I'm not so interested in that. And I think the lesson of physics is that one should be rather cautious about such, and maybe you're missing something fundamental. After all, that's how quantum mechanics was discovered. You know, people took literally the position and the momentum of a particle, and they had a classical picture of the atom with the electron going around the nucleus. And according to this picture, absolutely crazy. The electron would spiral into the nucleus and radiate its energy in electromagnetic waves in a microsecond. And so, you know, it just made no sense. And the solution was, we can't really observe the position and the momentum of the electron. So let's instead step backwards and talk about things we can observe, like the energy levels. This was Heisenberg's fundamental insight. All right, he said, okay, let's just treat X and P as mathematical entities, which don't have to be literal. And then, of course, they turned into matrices, which are even complex numbers, because the commutator XP is I, H-bar. And that was the way to progress. But you have to avoid taking, the lesson was to avoid taking too seriously logical things, structures in your theory, which cannot directly be measured. And that's certainly true of the universe beyond the dark energy scale. I should mention, my views are very unorthodox. I mean, I think everyone else is wrong, naturally. But take my views with a grain of salt. I believe much more strongly in the simplicity and comprehensibility of the universe than most other people. Most other people seem to have lost their minds. Anyway. Any other questions? All right, well, why don't you get up and walk around for a little bit, and let's come back in 5 minutes.